Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, the rest of Noam Chomsky's fine talk in Cambridge this April 24. Plus, relatedly, a brief tale of sex, violence, and squirrel Armageddon here in Darkest Connecticut. I hope you'll stay tuned. A few personal observations first, then on to Noam Chomsky. I beg your indulgence. Let me start with one of the finest poems in the English language. Spring has sprung, the grass has riz, I wonder where the flowers is. Well, actually, the flowers are out. Our backyard apple tree has already flowered, and the pink petals have dropped off, and the tree's green leaves are growing thicker and thicker. Our apple tree stands alone, surrounded by oaks. There's not another apple tree within at least a block. So our little apple tree remains unpollinated and fruitless. We have the house's previous owners to thank for that bit of boneheaded horticulture. Well, the tree looks pretty, and I guess it serves as a good metaphor for modern American culture. Somebody tried to improve on nature, and it didn't work. So the apple tree does not fulfill the most obvious purpose of apple trees, which is to produce apples. But the tree costs money, and it looks pretty, so we'll buy it. Welcome to America. I'm exaggerating the tree's uselessness, of course. It does do good things. It sequesters carbon. It emits oxygen. It helps keep the water cool in the bird bath below. And it gives us a place to hang our squirrel feeder. We didn't know we were buying a squirrel feeder. It was advertised as a bird feeder. It's a vertical cylinder with six small holes on the outside and six small perches filled with bird food. Once in a while, we see a robin or a chickadee on the feeder, while the squirrels are away sleeping off their lunch. More often, we see squirrels on the feeder. The squirrels are particularly fond of the sunflower seeds in the alleged bird food mix. I tell myself I should appreciate the squirrels. I suppose they're just as amusing to watch as birds. Not only that, they spill a good deal of bird food out of the feeder onto the ground. That provides food for the ground-feeding birds, who wouldn't use the feeder anyway. The food on the ground feeds the mourning doves, the cardinals, the grackles. A textbook example of symbiosis. I, the squirrels, the mourning doves, each species contributing to the life, health, and amusement of the other two. I ask myself, what would Hunter S. Thompson do if squirrels were plundering his bird feeder? I know what Hunter S. Thompson would do. He would grab a Smith & Wesson 357 Magnum revolver with a 6-inch barrel, open the kitchen window, and start shooting. He would blast two or three squirrels to kingdom come. In the process, he would destroy the bird feeder, and he would consider it time very well spent. Alas, this surefire solution is not available to me. A straight line runs from my kitchen window to my squirrel feeder to my neighbor's backyard to my neighbor's house. My neighbor would probably complain about bullets and small pieces of squirrel fur flying into his kitchen. So, symbiosis, I tell myself, and I restrain my urge to retaliate against the squirrel terrorists with a massive display of lethal force. Unlike the United States government, with its arsenal of fighter planes and cruise missiles, not to mention boots on the ground. And in this scene of potential hair-trigger carnage and destruction, there are signs of hope and life, too. In early May, robins build a nest on a bush right outside our living room window. They laid some pretty blue eggs and kept them warm by the usual method. The chicks hatched, begged for food, their father fed them, and now the whole family has flown off. I watched the whole show from 2 feet away. And an eastern phoebe built a nest on a porch overhang right above our front door. I can't see into the nest. I assume there are eggs inside. The robins are gone, but a phoebe is still sitting in her nest. Sometimes she flies off when I walk through the door below her. Sometimes she just sits there and gives me a look. Life persists. Nature endures. My heart leaps up when I behold the phoebe in her nest, as Wordsworth might have said. I feel it's time for me to go refill the squirrel feeder, so the cardinals and the mourning doves and what the heck the squirrels too can have a little treat. All of which is in Introduction to Noam Chomsky. Today we'll hear the remaining parts of his fine talk in Cambridge, Massachusetts, April 24, 2017. There are dreadful forces at work in the world, much more dreadful than a Smith & Wesson revolver. An out-of-control surveillance state. A press asleep at the switch. And a wildly out-of-control military greatly increasing its arsenal of nuclear bombs. This is beyond insanity. Yet there are some reasons to feel encouraged, too. A few causes for optimism. Sort of like our nesting phoebes and robins. Four of these reasons for hope have names, and Chomsky names them. Julian Assange, Chelsea Manning, Edward Snowden, and Bernie Sanders. To this list, let me add a fifth name, Noam Chomsky. Amy Goodman is the moderator. Here she is with Noam Chomsky.
Noam, I wanted to, before we get to your book, your latest book, ask you about this latest development in the United States. The director of the Central Intelligence Agency gave his first major address, and he focused on WikiLeaks. And it looks like now the U.S. is preparing an arrest warrant for Julian Assange, who's been holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London for almost 5 years now. Pompeo calling WikiLeaks a hostile non-state intelligence service, calling Julian Assange himself a demon, and said he's not protected by the First Amendment. Your thoughts?
Well, I think it speaks for itself. WikiLeaks has released lots of information that governments don't like. It's overwhelmingly information that citizens should have. It's information about what their governments are doing. Perfectly natural that systems of power don't want to be exposed. So they'll do what they can to prevent exposure. I think it's a disgraceful act. In fact, I think it's disgraceful even to keep Julian Assange holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy. I did visit him there once, but you can guess yourself. It's in many ways worse than imprisonment. At least if you're in prison, you can see other prisoners, and you can get out and look at the sunshine now and then. He's in a small apartment where you can't go out and go to the balcony, but that's about it. A couple of rooms inside a small apartment. It's not a big embassy. The embassy is like a kind of an apartment in London, surrounded by police and so on. There's been no credible basis for any of this, and to go on to try to carry it, to raise it to the level of criminal prosecutions, I think is, again, one of these efforts to look tough at home. The kind of effort that a government would carry out that is dedicated to trying to protect itself from exposure of facts that citizens should have, but systems of power don't want them to have. I think that's the crucial issue.
The suggestions are it has to do with his aiding and abetting perhaps Chelsea Manning and also Edward Snowden. Doing that with Edward Snowden, which he openly admits, while he's trapped in the Ecuadorian embassy.
If the charge is true, he should be honored for it. Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden are carried out heroic, courageous acts. They fulfilled the responsibility of somebody who takes citizenship seriously. That is, who believes that the people of a country ought to know something about what their government's up to. Okay? Like if their government is carrying out murderous, brutal attacks in Iraq, people should know about it. Takes us back to Martin Luther King's talk in 1967. If the government is, and corporations too, incidentally, are listening in to your telephone conversations and what you're doing, you know, tapping this discussion and so on, we should know about it. Governments have no right to do things like that. And people should know about it. And if they think it's okay, fine, let them decide, not do it in secret. I think people wouldn't agree to it. That's why it's kept secret. And these are people who exposed it at great risk to themselves. So those are heroic, courageous acts. If WikiLeaks was abetting them, more power to them. That's what they should be doing.
I mean, President Trump endorsed WikiLeaks, right? He said, I love WikiLeaks during the campaign.
When it was releasing things that he liked. Any system of power will do that. You release information that I like, it's great, but I don't want to be exposed.
Speaking of entities that President Trump doesn't like, he calls the press the enemy of the American people, the enemy of the people. Can you assess, as the media assesses President Trump in his first 100 days, the media's behavior?
Well, I think the media has fallen over backwards to try to give him some protection and leeway. I mean, there are things that are so ludicrous and outrageous that a reporter simply can't keep from saying something about them. Like there's one ridiculous claim after another that comes out of the tweets, 3 million illegal undocumented refugees voted for Clinton, Obama wiretapped the Trump Tower, one after another. My sense is, this is just a guess, that this is a media strategy, that it's the Bannon, Trump, Spicer strategy to try to keep attention focused on one or another form of lunacy, but not look at what's actually happening. And what's actually happening is that Paul Ryan and his associates behind the scenes are systematically and carefully dismantling every element of government that is of any benefit to people and that doesn't maximize corporate power and profit. I mean, the dedication of the Republican leadership, especially the Ryan-type leadership, their dedication to slavish servility to corporate power and wealth is just phenomenal. I mean, read this morning's business pages. Their latest step is to try to prevent exposure of complaints against banks that carry out improper activities. It is possible now, thanks to the Consumer Protection Act, for people to criticize when they think a bank has carried out some improper activity. But we got to keep that silent, because we have to protect corporations from any exposure of criminal activities they might carry out. I mean, down to that level, in fact, everywhere you look, I mean, the healthcare proposal was so shocking that it was a proposal basically to cut taxes for the rich and to ensure that poor and middle-class people, people who voted for Trump, in fact, don't get medical aid. As you saw, of course, the Congressional Budget Office estimated 24 million additional people uninsured. And there was an analysis of that by Steffi Woolhandler and David Himmelstein, two health specialists, just studying the relationship between lack of insurance and deaths. There's plenty of evidence about that. And it turns out that would have meant about 45,000 additional deaths a year. But that's okay as long as you cut taxes for the rich. And step by step, that's what's happening behind the facade of Trumpisms and Spicer antics before the press. And the press is pretty much falling for it. That's what they focus on, not what's being carried out. There is, of course, mild criticism of outrageous lies, but I think that just plays the game. That's what the lies are for. Then you can yell about the liberal press that is trying to undermine us. It's all a kind of a desperate effort to keep a con game going. Trump does have a base, a voter base. He's kicking them in the face with abandon. And the idea is, how do you hold on to them while you're doing this? Not an easy trick. And this, I think, is part of the con. There are people in the press who are pointing it out, Paul Krugman for one, but nothing like it should be.
And the resistance from the women's protests, massively larger than President Trump's inaugural crowd just the day after?
You have to look at the tweet.
To the protest just this week, from the March for Science on Earth Day on Saturday to the one that's coming up next Saturday, April 29th, another People's Climate March. The March for Science took place on every continent in the world. The People's Climate March promises to be much larger. Does this give you hope?
Well, there's a lot of reasons for hope. First of all, there is enormous resistance, the kind of thing that's happened sometimes before, like in the early 80s, when there was huge public opposition, enormous public opposition to the dangerous increase in nuclear weapons development. And it had an effect. Like I mentioned that the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists a couple of years ago, Doomsday Clock, went to 3 minutes to midnight. That's the closest it had been since 1984, when there was a major war threat with the increase in nuclear weapons threats. And it was significantly attenuated by popular action. And then, of course, there was the activism of the 60s and the 70s. It didn't end in the 60s by any means. So some of the most effective popular movements with the biggest impact on the society are really developed in the 70s, like the women's movement, the environmental movements, and so on. The seeds were in the 60s, but they weren't there yet. They were just barely beginning. All of that has really civilized the society, had lots of positive effects, and it goes on right to the present. So the most significant fact about the last election was not Trump's victory, which was very serious for the country and the world, but the astonishing success of Bernie Sanders' campaign. It's worth remembering that broke with over 100 years of U.S. political history. U.S. elections are pretty much bought. You can predict with remarkable precision electoral outcomes by looking at simple measures like campaign funding. There's very serious work on this. You can almost predict the outcome of an electoral campaign, president, House, Senate, just by looking at campaign funding. And of course, that's a predictor of policy as well. And that's been well known, from way back among people who run campaigns. And by now, the evidence is overwhelming. So what did Sanders do? Had no corporate support, no support from the wealthy, no support from the media, which mostly either dismissed or denigrated him. Unknown person, nobody had ever heard of him. He was proposing what amount to New Deal policies. By contemporary U.S. standards, that's what he called, with some justice, a political revolution. Actually, the policies he proposed, it wouldn't have surprised Dwight Eisenhower. He favored similar policies by and large. In fact, even said that anyone who doesn't accept New Deal programs just doesn't belong in our political system. I was a strong supporter of unions and so on. We've come quite a ways since then. But Sanders was a voice going back to the period when there was very rapid growth, egalitarian growth, the serious beginnings of an attack on some of the deep crimes of the country that go way back, like the racist crimes and others. Then came the 60s, the big civilizing effect, their consequences. Then a regression, the regression of the last 30, 40 years, the neoliberal programs and all their consequences. But Sanders broke with over a century of history. That's pretty serious. And it's having an effect. Fox News informed us, should thank them for that. They did a poll of popularity of political figures. How much do you like various political figures? One person was way in the lead, Bernie Sanders, far above anyone else, even higher among young people. Those are pretty serious achievements, and there's a lot to build on there. And in fact, out of the Sanders popular movement, there are developments growing, which I think are quite constructive and are coalescing and integrating with many other things that are happening. So there are plenty of grounds for hope, but we are in an extremely dangerous situation. Last January, a week or so into the Trump term, the minute hand was moved to 2.5 minutes to midnight. But since then, we have learned things which I suspect would lead the same group of analysts to push it even closer to midnight. What did we learn? Not that you read about it in the press, but what did you learn if you looked at what's happening? Well, there was an extremely important article that appeared in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, which is the main scientific journal that deals with nuclear and other strategic issues. What it discussed was the nuclear modernization programs that were initiated by Obama and are being carried forward more under Trump. And it pointed out, it's a technical article, but basically what it pointed out is that these modernization programs had already increased the destructive capacity of the U.S. nuclear weapon systems by maybe a factor of 3. Enough, they said, to completely wipe out the Russian deterrent. Okay? It's not that the Russians don't know this. Russia does not have our sophisticated early warning systems, satellite warning systems. They have much more primitive ones. They don't get much advance warning of an alleged attack. There have been many close calls in the past because of this. Well, now they're aware that the U.S. modernization programs are able to completely wipe out their deterrent because we've so expanded already our destructive capacity by a huge factor. And as they point out in the article, this means that the system of stability by which the world has been kind of hanging by a thread, a pretty slender thread, it's being seriously threatened. Means that in the event of some rising tension, and there's plenty of tensions at the Russian border, not at the Mexican border, at the Russian border, plenty of them and plenty of provocations, they might just out of desperation decide, well, we better launch a preemptive strike or we're gone. We don't have a deterrent. That's what's being developed. It's another great contribution of human intelligence to develop means to make our own destruction far more likely. That's what we've learned in the last couple of months. These should be screaming headlines all over the place. There should be headlines about the Republican Party trying to destroy the prospects for organized human life. Now, that's what journalism would be if it were concerned with bringing to people the things that are significant for people who live in a democratic society, who can make decisions about how to deal with the problems they face in their lives. Almost nothing about it. It's not a secret, you know, it's not classified. You can find out about it. It's a free country in that respect, an important respect. You should respect and honor that. But these are the things that are happening right now. And it means that the sledgehammers that we've constructed in our brilliance to threaten our survival are getting far more dangerous, while the political mechanisms that might lead to a sensible reaction are being destroyed. And we see the impact in the rise of anger, contempt for institutions, irrational reactions, the kinds of things, scapegoating, you know, things that are pretty dangerous. We've, again, constructed a remarkable, perfect storm.
Well, Noam, thank you not only for this evening, but for your decades of commitment to improving the human condition.
Thank you.
Noam Chomsky and Amy Goodman speaking Monday evening, April 24th, 2017, at the First Parish Church in Cambridge on the topic of Noam's new book, Requiem for the American Dream. This event was recorded by your radio announcer, Chuck Rosina, and posted for distribution on the website radioforall.net. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Chuck. Chomsky's talk supported his new book, Requiem for the American Dream. Look for it in your favorite corporate-controlled bookstore chain. They probably put the book in the back, on a low shelf marked Vintage Tractors, Shortwave Radio, and Conspiracy Theories. One point Chomsky made struck me as an especially shrewd insight. All the lunacy of the Trump administration, all the chaotic staff changes, the constant contradictions, the nutty tweets, all this is a diversion, a distraction. And the mainstream press is falling for the ruse, hook, line, and sinker. The real story is how the extremist Republican Congress and the extremist Republican Department secretaries are rapidly tearing down every consumer protection, every environmental protection, every civil liberty, every vestige of a restraint on the corporations. This is the real story. It's happening in public, but the news media and the citizens are too distracted by the nutty tweets and the rest of the Trump circus show to notice. Thank you for listening to New World Notes. Check out our archive of past shows at our website, which remains newworldnotes.blogspot.com. On behalf of the entire New World Notes staff, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimi non carborundum. Remember that war is not healthy for phoebes, squirrels, children, and other living things. And please tune in again next week. A bientôt.